This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
718-625-0080. That's 718-625-0080.
This has been a list of events from the WBAI Community Bulletin Board.
Let us know what's going on in your community. You can send an email to cbb@wbai.org. That's cbb@wbai.org.
You can fax us at 212-747-1698. That's 212-747-1698.
Or write to us at WBAI, 120 Wall Street, 10th floor, New York, New York, 10005. Whichever way you get in touch with us, be sure to include a contact phone number and allow at least 2 weeks lead time. I'm Eugene Hammond.
I'm Victor Takeall.
I'm Vajra Kilgour. Become a member of WBAI at WBAI.org.
Thanks to Roombuzz for the music.
And thank you very, very much for tuning in to listener-supported, commercial-free community radio WBAI at 99.5 FM. We're on the web at WBAI.org. Good afternoon. My name is Michael G. Haskins, your radio host and guide. 63 degrees and sunny in New York City. It's certainly a lovely day outside. I didn't need that heavier coat. It's a winter coat I have on. So take that coat off and govern yourself accordingly as you make way outside this afternoon. It's noon and it's time for Women, Body and Soul.
Body and Soul, correspondent Gina McCauley of WhatAboutOurDaughters.com gives us a free black woman's take on a culture that defends violent criminals and throws their women and girl targets under the bus as collateral damage. Then, we'll look at child sexual abuse and seek to understand why so many people defend the perpetrators while blaming victims when they're girls. We'll examine how this double standard impacts African American girls in particular. We'll also explore how we can end the language that grooms consenting bystanders and victims, and how we can end child sex abuse. Stay tuned to WBAI Pacifica Radio 99.5 FM, streaming live online at WBAI.org.
This is Gina McCauley for the blog What About Our Daughters, and thanks once again for having me here on Women, Body, and Soul. Over the weekend, I got a series of emails and tweets about a horrific, violent attack on a 7-year-old girl in Trenton, New Jersey. People were shocked. They were horrified. And they were wondering what they could do. I, too, was horrified. But I was not shocked. For almost 3 years, I have been chronicling violent attacks against black women and girls, the kinds of attacks one might expect to find in war zones, not school zones. In a similar case, there was an 11-year-old girl in Milwaukee. She was gang raped by over 20 men and boys in one room while adults and bystanders went about their lives in an adjacent room. They did nothing to intervene on her behalf. When the last suspect in that case was sentenced to 5 years in prison, one of the neighborhood women responded angrily, quote, 5 years? 10 years? That's ridiculous. She went on to say, quote, "They are getting time for nothing. That girl, she knew what she was doing." End quote. That girl that the angry neighborhood woman was speaking about was 11 years old. The oldest attacker in that case was over 40. Case after case, horror after horror, the same sad, cruel story repeating itself. And these are the cases where the victims survived their attacks. Ramona Moore, Dorothy Dixon, Ebony Dorsey, and Denia Jackson all died in some of the most gruesome ways imaginable. Though their deaths might garner local or even national attention briefly, eventually the attention wanes and people go on with their lives, only to be shocked once again when human beings met out cruelty and savagery on the most innocent among us. We are left to wonder. We wonder why. We wonder how. And we wonder what we can do to fix this. My blog is unique in that the crimes we cover almost always involve black-on-black crime. And we have observed over these 3 years that the outpouring of sympathy for black criminal defendants almost always eclipses the focus on black victims of crime. In fact, there is a concerted effort to downplay, dismiss, or marginalize these heinous crimes. Supporters of these criminal defendants often line up to plead their cases and provide a litany of justifications for why they did what they did and why society should offer leniency. Poverty, lack of education, absent fathers, the decay of the black family, the moral decay in general. The message is clear. All must be sacrificed to protect the black criminal from the system, with little to no regard to the broken lives they leave behind. Under the current system, some black people, women and girls in particular, are collateral damage, and their sacrifice is necessary for the greater good. Perhaps this case will be an aberration. After all, the victim is a 7-year-old girl. But one has to wonder. One has to wonder why this apartment building in Trenton, New Jersey, was allowed to incubate crime that eventually metastasized into debauchery and evil of the highest order. One has to wonder how many other girls whose names and faces we will never know had their lives shattered by the same group of men who gathered in that vacant apartment on that day. One has to wonder whether the institutions of the black community, which have made the plights of black urban terrorists, also known as criminals, their poster children, will ever have room to consider the carnage that these criminals leave behind. One has to wonder when we will put as much energy into dismantling the system of misogyny and abuse that turns women and girls into objects as we do into railing against the prison industrial complex. One has to wonder how many times we will hear about gruesome stories like those of Ramona Moore, Dorothy Dixon, Ebony Dorsey, and Denia Jackson before we decide that we will move heaven and earth to do what we can to keep the most vulnerable among us safe. One has to wonder. This has been Gina McCauley for the blog whataboutourdaughters.com, and thanks for having us once again here on Women, Body, and Soul.
That was our correspondent, Gina McCauley. You can check out her blog online, whataboutourdaughters.com. She's also founder of Blogging While Brown and Michelle Obama Watch. This is your host, Natalie Tondiway. You're listening to Women, Body, and Soul, WBAI Pacifica Radio, 99.5 FM, New York City. We're streaming live online at WBAI.org. As reported by police and in the press at the end of March 2010, a 15-year-old took her 7-year-old stepsister to a unit in their Trenton, New Jersey apartment complex where a group of men had sex with the 15-year-old and paid her money to also assault her 7-year-old sister. The men threatened to kill the child if she screamed or told anyone. Police believe as many as a dozen people were in the apartment during the assaults and say everyone in the apartment when the raping occurred could be legally culpable. This calculated sale of a child for purposes of rape and the devastating sexual violation of children that ensued is unfortunately one of many stories that shatter the lives of girls throughout this country and around the world. The largest retrospective national study on the prevalence of child sexual abuse found that 27% of women and 16% of men reported abuse. The National Clearinghouse on Child Abuse and Neglect recognizes that these child abuse statistics are probably vast underestimates, since most abuse and neglect is never reported to the state. Nevertheless, what is actually reported can help us understand the scope and nature of child sexual abuse. The National Resource Council estimates that the actual U.S. rates of childhood sexual abuse range to a high of 62% of the population. The higher estimate included sexualized exposure without touching, such as masturbating in front of children. Girls are sexually abused 3 times more often than boys. Studies examining victimization in boys have recorded rates of sexual abuse as high as 31% among U.S. males. Male victimization is very hard to estimate due to beliefs that sex between older women and boys is desirable and that male victimization of boys indicates lack of masculinity or acquiescence by the child. More than 90% of sexual abuse perpetrators are men. However, sexual abuse perpetrated by women appears underreported. Sexual abuse offenders are most often acquaintances of their victims, followed by family members and strangers. The impact of sexual abuse can be devastating for survivors. They are at higher risk of mental health, social, and functioning problems, resulting from feelings of powerlessness, guilt, shame, stigmatization, and low self-esteem. This powerlessness damages a person's coping skills and reduces the ability to protect oneself from further abuse throughout life. Here to help us define and stop abuse and examine its impact are our guest, Deborah Donovan Rice, Executive Director of StopItNow.org. Stop It Now prevents the sexual abuse of children by mobilizing adults, families, and communities to take action before a child is harmed. The organization provides support information and resources for adults to take responsibility for creating safer communities. Also joining us here live in studio is Ted Bunch, co-founder of A Call to Men. A Call to Men is a national movement of men committed to ending violence and discrimination against women and girls, promoting healthy manhood and changing men's behavior, and to shift related social norms. Welcome, Deborah and Ted. Thank you so much for taking the time to have this dialogue with us here at WBAI Pacifica Radio. This recently reported gang rape of a 7-year-old girl in Trenton, New Jersey, has really highlighted the violence and rape that too many children throughout the world face at some point in their childhood. And I wanted to have a conversation because I'm just alarmed at some of the feedback and comments that I've been reading and hearing these other incidents. And I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Glad to be here, Natalie. Thanks for the invite.
You know, some of the disturbing commentary I'm hearing, you know, people are defending male perpetrators or, you know, their female victims are spoken of as somehow having provoked or set themselves up for attack or even seducing their rapists. And these, keep in mind, are children. I'm also hearing that these rapes being discussed as if sex with female children is acceptable or par for the course. I mean, I think we've all seen this in the larger cultural conversation surrounding artists like R. Kelly, and his admitted predilection for sex and relationships with teenage girls. And we also saw this kind of protect the perpetrator commentary surrounding filmmaker Roman Polanski, who is really a fugitive bail jumper and convicted felon who has pled guilty to raping a 13-year-old girl. Now, I can only imagine that if these were allegations of sex acts and raping of young boys, that the public response would probably not be as accepting or supporting of the accused or seek to blame young men for allegedly, you know, provoking incidents of rape. And even in this gang rape of a 7-year-old girl in Trenton, New Jersey, we're hearing her own father defending several of the accused men who admit to being in the apartment building during the assaults. So, you know, Deborah, I wanted to have you on so that you could take us back to the basics and actually define what sexual abuse is, because it seems that many people are unclear about what constitutes sexual assault and believe that it's acceptable on some level to assault girls.
Well, any sexual activity between an adult and a child is sexual abuse, whether there's touching involved or not. So I think, you know, the description of people victim blaming, that victim blaming is something that's not new. Those who've worked in the adult assault field have been dealing with this for many, many years. But victim blaming, when it comes to blaming children, I start to want to ask those folks who are saying this, asking them, you know, well, what's your background? Were you victimized as a child? Because I think that sometimes the lack of community support for children in general, and especially I think around sexual violence, some of the folks that are probably making those statements have lived with the secret of having been sexually abused themselves and feeling unsupported, uncared for, and, you know, and I talk with these folks and have over the years when I was a therapist and then now in the prevention world, and I know that sometimes you just, there's a sense of, they're saying to me, well, why don't, you know, they can just get over it, or, you know, they go down that path of sort of minimizing the impact on themselves, which then leads them to some thinking that from where I sit and where it sounds like you sit, Natalie, that we just scratch our heads and say, how could they possibly think that a child somehow assisted this person in abusing them, either by the way they dressed or the way they acted? I mean, children, parents dress children. Parents are the ones who are there to, or family members. So it's, children can't give consent. I think that that's the another area where we have a lot of confusion. The term itself isn't even applicable to children.
You know, that's such an interesting door to open, because I feel like we've gotten to a point where we've normalized and even romanticized sex between underage girls and adult men. Can you give us an understanding of the laws surrounding sex, age, and consent?
Well, it varies in all of our, all the different states have different statutes. So it's sometimes 15, sometimes 16, sometimes 17. Mm-hmm. So it's important for parents to know what that age range is to counsel their boys and their girls, their teenage boys and girls who may be becoming sexually active.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's also, you know, but aside from where that is, I mean, if you think about whether or not a 9-year-old child or an 11-year-old child is capable of managing the big feelings that come with being sexually active, I think, you know, that's the question, you know, that I would love to hear what people have to say, you know, how, or is it that in our culture at this point in time, we have come to a place where we have devalued sexual activity to the point that we're saying, oh, well, it's not a big deal no matter what. It's just not a big deal. So, you know, so we lost our own sexual integrity as a culture, as individuals, as a larger culture. I mean, there are a lot of signs that show that that has definitely been eroded. And then, you know, another whole area of discussion could be the, you know, the commercialization of sex to sell things, whether it's to sell things to parents, like little high heel shoes for girls who are, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years old. I mean, there's so many examples. I don't, you know, we don't even need to go into them.
And so if a girl is under the age of consent in her state and she gives birth, what are the implications of that? What does that mean in terms of the laws surrounding sex, age, and consent?
You mean, what does it mean for the person who...
Is it viewed as a crime?
Yes. Yes, it will be. If it falls under the statutes, then it would be statutory rape if she's underage.
And I asked that just in light of a case in China in which a 9-year-old girl is said to be the youngest person on record to give birth in the country, because I've been hearing comments and seeing comments such as, well, you know, some 9-year-old girls are fast or some 9-year-old girls are hot. And, I mean, I find this mind-boggling, but I'm hearing this from adult women. So that's why I bring up this issue of what is our reality and our understanding around sex, age, and consent. I completely acknowledge the psychological issues you're talking about, but it seems like for some people who aren't in touch with those aspects of sexuality and the reality that children can't manage these kind of relationships, they may be able to better relate to the idea of legality since they're construing 9-year-old girls as being provocative and seductive. And I'm just wondering, is this something that you're seeing when you're dealing with people in your organizational capacity, this distortion of childhood sexuality?
I'm not. I'm not hearing, we're not hearing from, most of the folks that contact us are concerned about a child who mm-hmm. might be being abused, mm-hmm. or they're concerned about what they can do individually to make sure that, say, their newborn niece is going to be safe in her entire life span. So I'm not hearing from the folks that you're referencing. Mm-hmm. I know that those attitudes are around, and I go back to ask the question of, what were the opportunities? I mean, what's the history of the people who are taking that attitude? What have been their life experiences that have shaped them in the direction to somehow assign sexuality that is geared toward sexual intercourse, mm-hmm. expression of sexuality geared toward sexual intercourse? What is it that leads them to believe that children are doing that? Now, children are sensual beings, and in healthy sexual development, we have on our website at stopitnow.org mm-hmm. a list of, what you might expect at certain ages for children, when you might see them masturbating, when they might be having these kinds of questions or that kind of concern. So if you go to those pages, then, a person could be understanding more about what is developmentally expected. But I would really love to have a conversation with some of those folks who are taking that position to better understand how they arrived at that particular idea.
And it's interesting that you brought up the capacity in which people reach out to your organization in terms of a desire to protect children that they are around. And I was just wondering, how can we discern grooming for sexual abuse when it involves parents or immediate relatives? And I ask this in light of a recent case in Texas where a father was discovered to have been showing his young daughter's pornography via a webcam sex worker. And there was a lot of controversy afterwards, and a lot of people were defending his right to show his daughters this pornography and engage in this kind of behavior with this. And the local district attorney called it frustrating because, the law does allow, the law says that it is wrong and endangerment to show pornography to children unless they're your own. So how do we discern what is grooming for abuse when it involves parents or immediate family?
Well, there are two things in play, at least two, probably a lot more, in the example you gave. But I'll respond to, what are the warning signs in an adult, which mm-hmm. I will talk about these briefly, and your listeners can also go to, again, our website, and there's a tip card, actually, that on one side has the warning signs, and then on the other side it has what a family can do to help support and protect from sexual abuse ever occurring in their family. But, the person who has a sexual interest in children, certain things will show up, such as they're very likely to be people who don't have good personal boundaries. They insist on hugging or kissing or tickling a child, even when the child doesn't want this kind of physical contact. Often they might have bad boundaries around sharing information that is either personal or private, and they're sharing that information with children. So, and then it seems, somebody who's unusually interested in children's or teens' bodies or sexual development and makes comments about that, or insists on telling dirty jokes around when their children present, when children and youth present, and also somebody who misreads typical gestures of friendliness or affection as having some kind of sexual connotation. And somebody who encourages silence and secrets in children. And they may even have a special child friend that they give gifts to or spend time with in some way. So these are, you know, six potential warning signs. And I say potential warning signs because any one of these alone may or may not indicate that this person has sexual interest in children. Mm-hmm. But in some kind of combination, and I bet you anything, if your listeners took just a minute or even 30 seconds and thought about the last family gathering they went to or the last, say, you know, friendly barbecue or whatever, that I bet you there's at least one person in that group that people are like, you know, I really wouldn't want my child to be interacting with that person. Or that's somebody that I know is going to tell dirty jokes, and I'm just going to do this to help keep my child away from them. You know, so those are the opportunities that I think are very difficult for us to take in those social settings where we don't suspect that they're actually abusing a child, but we can see that there's something that's different about how they behave around children, and then what are you going to do about that? Are you going to take action? Are you going to talk with the other parents and see if they see some of the same things so that you feel like you're not isolated with this concern? That would be one of the first steps I would recommend people take. So I'm just, and then the second part that I wanted to bring up is, you know, when the law says that it's not okay to show pornography unless it's, you know, with children that aren't your own, then what they're doing is reinforcing something in our culture that's been around for a very, very, very long time, that something that is called the family bubble, where the privacy of the family is sacrosanct over the individual right to safety and to live a violence-free life. Mm. Now, those laws are in place. But what I want to ask is, what is it that we as individuals, what's our stand? What are our values around individual rights of a child to be safe, even if it means the family name is going to be smeared if something comes out that there's been sexual abuse? I mean, if we don't address our unwillingness to accept that we're going to have to walk through a bunch of shame and pain for children to be protected and to feel and to be safe, then I don't think we're going to make any progress on this issue.
And I'm just wondering, when I think about the reality of how sexual abuse is played out in families, and I loved your example of think back to the last family gathering and think about that one relative who everyone kind of has questions about and doesn't want to leave their kids with. On the flip side of that, when we're dealing with those kind of people and families, often we actually kind of tiptoe around those people and don't confront this kind of abuse. And when we do, sometimes these people are actually defended and the people who call them out are actually pushed out of the family. And there's so many politics under that. I mean, I know of so many instances in which mothers have refused to acknowledge sexual abuse of their children because of their ties, their economic ties to the abuser and the relationship that they're putting above their children. How do we begin, knowing that we would be stepping into these waters if we step forward and go from consenting bystander to a witness who speaks, what are we supposed to do? How do we begin that journey, and what do we need to think about and where do we reach out to?
I'll start where the part where I mentioned about having allies. Mm-hmm. Having one ally within the family at least before you make any, you know, take any action. Having looked around for who else can be an ally. Maybe there's somebody in the church. Maybe they're, you know, who else can be an ally if you're going to be able to have access to the internet and you want to learn about this? How much knowledge can you get via the internet? who can you call? We do have a helpline service right now, even though the hours have been drastically cut over the last year due to the, you know, financial downturn, but we're looking to build that back up. But
and can you share that helpline with us?
Stop it. Why am I fumbling here? It's 1-800. Mm-hmm. 1-800 prevent. 1-888 prevent. And so, having somebody that has the has worked with other people who are in that really awkward place of trying to figure out what your first step is. And, oh, by the way, what might happen? What's the second, third, fourth, fifth steps? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very much an incremental process to begin to take action that's actually going to result in the child being protected. So getting to the point of where you're going to talk to that family member about, you know, about what you understand about sexual abuse or how you want your child to be treated. You don't even have to mention sexual abuse. You could just say, you know, when you do this behavior, this is something that's not okay around my child.
Okay.
But
we're coming actually to the midpoint of our hour, so we're going to need to take a break for station identification, a couple other things. Thank you so much for that point, and we'll come back to the conversation with stopitnow.org and a call to men. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Somi. I'm a singer from Uganda and Rwanda. When I'm in New York, I like to listen to WBAI 99.5 FM. Habari, mimi naitwa Somi, mwimbaji wa Uganda na Rwanda. Kama nipo New York, napenda kusikiliza WBAI 99.5 FM.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country, a media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Oh, sister, have I got news for you?
This is Natalie Tandiwe, host of Women, Body, and Soul on WBAI Pacifica Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. Today, our conversation is about the sexual abuse of girls, and I'm speaking with Deborah Donovan Rice, executive director of StopItNow.org, and Ted Bunch, co-founder of A Call to Men. You know, one of the things I wanted to talk about is the double standard. You know, we seem to believe that when men or boys make sexual advances toward boys, that it is molestation, sexual abuse, rape, and the perpetrators of sexual abuse of boys are deemed deviant, sick, in need of swift punishment. However, when men and boys make sexual advances or sexually abuse girls, we hear people defend perpetrators, trivialize the abuse, and sometimes blame girls. Now, this kind of double standard normalizes sexual abuse of girls, but it has a peculiar impact on African American girls because black females face violence and sexual assault at 2.5 times the rate of women of other races, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics. I really want to turn to you, Ted Bunch, as leader of A Call to Men, a national movement of men committed to ending violence against women and girls, as well as promoting healthy manhood, and just kind of lead this uncharted conversation. You know, African American girls are documented to be the most vulnerable to sexual violence in this country, yet I hear some of the most intense defense of predators and trivialization of abuse from other African American women. And there's such a deep silence among black men as well as traditional civil rights organizations and the black church as to how to confront these predators and end the violence that our girls are facing. As I mentioned before, even in the gang rape of this 7-year-old girl in Trenton, New Jersey, her own father is defending several of the accused men who admit to being in the apartment during the assaults. I'm just wondering, what do you make of this schizophrenic combination of predator defense and silence when it comes to sexual abuse of African-American girls, and why does it matter, Ted?
Well, thank you very much, Natalie, for the opportunity to be here with you. And I want to also thank Gina McCauley for her comments earlier and also Ms. Rice. I'm really privileged to be a part of this conversation. When we look at defending male perpetration when it comes to violence against women, whether it's in the African-American community or any other community, what we're doing really is defending male privilege. It's really become synonymous with that. And we give the benefit of the doubt to men, and we have skepticism and blame for women. So this comes from really the socialization of men, how we're taught to be men, and how women are devalued in our overall society, but certainly in the African-American community as well. And when we look at, our work with the Call to Men is around the prevention of domestic violence and the prevention of sexual violence. And our work is really with the belief that most of the men who perpetrate these crimes, with most men, the minority of men are the ones who perpetrate the crimes, meaning that most men are well-meaning men, men who do the right thing in their lives. But our silence is as much of a problem as the perpetration itself. In other words, those men who perpetrate the violence only do so because we allow them to through our silence. So when you see a situation like this where even the father or stepfather is defending or not seeing anything wrong with what some of those men have done, whether it's a 7-year-old girl or a 27-year-old woman, it's wrong. And that's given the benefit of the doubt to men, that we are socialized to protect men at the expense of women. Women are, again, through our socialization, when you look at male dominance, patriarchy, sexism, all of this supports men's violence against women, even encourages men's violence against women. And as we speak to men, whether it's white men or certainly men in African-American communities and communities of color, many men in communities of color say, well, this male privilege you're talking about, I don't have that. When the police pull me over, this or that. Well, the male privilege that men of color have is not the same as the male privilege that white men have, because male privilege that white men have ties into their race privilege and can't be separated from that. So you're right. When the police come, whether I'm in New York or Tallahassee, I know to put my hands at 2 o'clock and 10 o'clock, where I don't think, you know, a white man can go right into his glove compartment and pull out his registration and not worry about the same thing. So my privilege may not be operating there, but it's certainly operating in my relationship with women. And that the same oppressive systems that are on me are on her, and I'm on her as well. So when we look at domestic violence or sexual violence, and we look at women being blamed for the violence that men perpetrate, women being blamed for where they were, what she wore, all of those things is really excusing the behavior of men. It's really giving us a pass. And for men not to be in the conversation is also around the issue of entitlement, that we have the luxury not to care. We have the luxury not to be involved because, again, women in our socialization, women are here to serve us and to meet our needs, and we get to determine what that is.
That's interesting. I'm curious, just given the level of personal, kind of person-to-person work that you're doing, where there's an intimacy to the kind of activism and advocacy that you're doing, the work you're doing with men, what are some of the things that you're hearing from men in their testimony about these issues of sexual violence and child sex abuse that we don't necessarily hear in mainstream media or conversations that might surprise us or teach us something?
Well, again, I think that most men, right, when we look at the overwhelming majority, of violence against women is men's violence against women, the majority of men are not violent. And that those empowered bystanders, those are the men who see it as something wrong. They see it as what we say is a violation, meaning well-meaning men say is a violation, is when a man physically does something to a woman. In other words, whether it's domestic violence and he hits her, whether it's sexual violence and he rapes her, we've all been taught that men have that women have less value than men, all of us. We've been taught this. This is part of our socialization. It's in the fabric of our socialization, is that women have less value than men. Women are the objects for men, and women are the property of men. So a woman being objectified, if a woman walks down the street and a man touches her as she goes by, we may see something wrong with that. But if we look at her as she goes by, we don't see anything wrong with that. In other words, there's this physical line that gets crossed, which speaks to our entitlement and privilege right there, that we as men get to determine what that line is, right? Where the line for her might have been when he started looking at her before he touched her. Maybe that was her violation. She didn't feel comfortable with that. So when we look, when we talk to men, we really have to deconstruct, and we do this around the country. We do this with professional athletes. We've just gotten back from 2 weeks in South Africa dealing with the same issue. When we talk to men, we really have to deconstruct that socialization, that patriarchy. We have to take it apart. We have to unpack it. Addressing the issue of how all of us have been socialized to have women, to see women as having less value, see women as property, and see women as objects. Even the women who are exploited, you know, this 7-year-old girl was trafficked. That's trafficking.
Yeah.
So when we look at trafficking, so we can certainly focus on the 15-year-old girl who brought her there, who seems damaged at 15.
And was also being assaulted.
Right. So when we look at her, and you know, what men will do is look at, well, she brought her there, she made a choice to do that, or look at the porn star and the money she's making, or look at the woman at the club who's doing the lap dance, or all these other things, mm-hmm. but who's fueling this industry is men.
Right.
And so, and this is a multi-billion dollar industry. More money is made through pornography and trafficking than the NFL, NBA, and Major League Baseball combined every year. And that's not just from the bad guys who are at the who we feel uncomfortable with at our family gatherings. That's from most of the men at our family gatherings are supporting that in one way or the other.
Thank you, Ted. You're so, I have a question, Ted, in terms of the conversations you're having with men, because it's my hunch that even though the privilege may be there, that it doesn't equate to feelings of efficacy and worthwhileness and belonging in their world. And that, I mean, because we hear all these, you know, you hear a lot of comedians making jokes about how powerful women are. So on some level, I'm wondering if there's sort of a public privilege but a private undercutting of feeling, powerless in some ways in their lives.
That's an interesting question. I'll let you take that time.
Thank you. That's an excellent question. And let me just say that, you know, those men who say that women are, you know, come across like women are gaining ground.
Mm-hmm.
it's really about that women are challenging our privilege, challenging our entitlements. In other words, the Violence Against Women Act, right?
Yep.
I've come across men. There's even organizations that are men's organizations that are working against having the Violence Against Women Act supported, which really means that, wow, they have a Violence Against Women Act. What are they going to want next? Freedom? You know, it's really that way. So I would say that what happens with men is that when you talk about the powerlessness, it's not that we have a powerlessness, but it's that if we are doing anything that's against the social norm that supports manhood as we've defined it, which is very problematic, if we do anything about that, including supporting women, empowering women and girls, then it somehow doesn't make us a man. There's something wrong with us. Our sexual orientation is questioned immediately because you're either a punk or you're weak or you're all these other things, because we call it the man box. And there's all these ingredients of the man box. And even to be on the, to even if, I challenge men who are listening right now to, at their next family gathering or at their, when they're watching the playoff games tonight, to say to their buddies, hey man, I heard something on the radio today. I want to talk about respecting women. Let's have that conversation. I want to talk about how we objectify women. Let's have that conversation. I want to talk about how we interact with women. Are we really being respectful? They'll tell him, man, sit down, you little something or other.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And those words are used intentionally to keep us out of the box. And they're sexist words. They're heterosexist words. They're all these things.
They're usually homophobic, too,
when it comes to trying to
put men down.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when I say heterosexist, I'm including homophobia in that, because it's all of these things that say, hey, we're not going to discuss that because we don't have to. Privilege allows us not to have to worry about that. And so you are going to get this backlash of men who feel like, wow, we need to do something because women are getting too much already, right? Because domestic violence has been seen as a private issue which served men. Privacy based on English common law, everything in the house was owned by that man. The same thing you're talking about here with the family bubble. That's what we're talking about. That bubble is male privilege. That's what the bubble is.
I want to interject just to talk language for a second. You know, one of the things I understand, and we all agree on the word perpetrator, and now there's this language around bystander. So we know what it is to perpetrate this violence, and we know what we call those people. We know what it is to have consenting silence. We call those people bystanders. But what is the word for a man who stands up and interjects and prevents sexual abuse or abuse of women and girls? There is no, like, blanket word for that. From where you stand in this movement, what's that word?
A man doing the right thing. I mean, you know, I don't know if there's a word. You know, feminist, simply the definition of feminist is respect for women.
Right.
So, but that's a loaded word for many people.
Exactly.
So I would just say it's a man who's doing the right thing. It's just a man who does the right thing, a righteous man. In the same way that, you know, because people have asked me, oh, thank you for doing this work. Well, it's kind of like if I was a white person doing work to end racism, would I expect thanks?
Mm-hmm.
Or would someone thank me? They probably say, well, yeah, you should be doing it because it's the right thing to do. And that's the way I kind of feel. It's just men doing the right thing.
Well, Ted, I'm wondering if they're thinking that they're just glad you're doing it and they don't have to.
That might be some of it, but I think there's true thanks. But I wanted to point out the language thing because language is about power. There's a reason that there's no one word in this in our lexicon to cut down a white man in a way that hurts him, because language is about power. And then invisibility or lack of language is also about power. So the fact that there really is no word for that kind of fierce advocate for girls and women coming from men, I mean, even you point out that if it's a woman, we call her a feminist. There's just no word for this. It means there's no expectation, that there's no place. And so, you know, even for young women and men growing up and trying to find their way, there's almost nothing for them to reach for in terms of, like, building these kind of healthy norms and placing yourself somewhere in the continuum of, you know, being an advocate for justice and the right thing. I want to open the phones. We probably have time for maybe one phone call just so that we hear from people. You know, I've seen so much. It's 212-209-2900 is our phone number. There's been so much talk in light of this case in Trenton and the rape of this 7-year-old girl. And as you've pointed out, the sex trafficking of this girl. And as I've pointed out, the double assault of both a 15-year-old and a 7-year-old. So if there are listeners who want to join the conversation, 212-209-2900, that's the number to reach us and join us here in the station. And I just remind everyone, you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio. And I'm here in the studio with Ted Bunch from A Call to Men, and on the line is Deborah Donovan Rice, Executive Director of StopItNow.org. We're talking about child sexual abuse. And it looks like we actually do have one caller on the line, but until we get to that caller. Ted, I just also want to talk about the silence. You know, within our community, as African-American people, we've experienced so much in terms of racism and struggle for rights that there's a certain defensiveness around talking about these issues or, quote, airing dirty laundry. And it's taboo to talk about issues where we confront abusers who are statistically likely to be black men. You know, let's come back to the point. We have a couple of calls, and I always love to include our listeners in the conversation. I'm going to take this first call. Listener, you're on the air.
Oh, I'm so glad I got through, because I am aware of a situation, and I just need someone else's opinion of it.
I'm going to ask you to quickly frame it as a question so that Deborah
okay.
and perhaps
mother
Ted can respond.
Who takes her 14-year-old daughter to spend the night at her boyfriend's house on a constant basis and on school nights?
Deborah, can you respond? And do you have a particular question, or are you just asking about whether or not it's appropriate and how you should respond?
Yeah, just I need some other's opinion on it.
Okay, and what's your relationship to the two so I can give Deborah the perspective?
Well, I just want to know, I'm aware of a situation.
Okay.
I'm in a conundrum here.
Okay, Deborah, can you take that question?
Absolutely. I think that, first of all, with just that little bit of information, what I would do is ask the caller to consider just for herself writing down what her concerns are and then having a conversation with the mother about what the caller's concerns are. And then she'll hopefully have enough information to then think about what her next steps may be. But if the mother is, you know, you would look for signs of defensiveness or signs of, you know, maybe the mother hadn't really thought about it. Maybe this is a mom who's extremely busy and, you know, she would appreciate a friend saying, you know, I was listening to the show and I know that these are some of the warning signs. Have you seen anything like this in your boyfriend? Because I think I saw him do this, but I'm not sure. And she said she's your daughter, but I just, you know, and refer her to our website for more information about some of the warning signs are.
I was just, and caller, we're going to move you off the air just to take other calls, and I'm going to reiterate that number. It's 1-800-PREVENT, and the website is stopitnow.org. And I want to say to you, thank you so much for calling with that question and for being an advocate for that child.
Yes.
Okay, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi. And do you have a question for Deborah or Ted or myself?
I guess, I do have a question. My main question would be, how do you socialize women to make better choices about the men who they allow in their lives?
You know, I'm actually going to let Ted take this question, and I'm going to stop you there so we answer the first part of your question, because this is one of my most favorite least favorite questions. Go ahead, Ted.
Yeah, but it's a good question, and it's a common question. And again, I would say that it's a question, not that this is the intent, but it's still around blaming the victim. Because my response to that is that if she was to go out and grab any man on the street, it's more likely that he'd be socialized to see her as again having less value, see her as property, and see her as an object than not. So I would say that it's less about her choices than it is about the behavior of men. And if we start addressing the behavior of men and reframing the behavior of men, then it doesn't matter who she chooses; he'd be a respectful man.
Interesting answer. I'm going to take another call. Caller, you're on the air. Do you have a question for Deborah Donovan Rice or Ted Bunch?
Yes, I have a question for both of you guests. A question and a comment.
Sure.
How do we go about deconstructing the socialization that is now afoot? And not just now, it's been going on for years, but it's accumulating now, where sexuality or the forceful of your sexuality is equated with power. The other day I was watching an Oprah program where she had some women who were former porn stars taking hold of the reins in terms of how they produce porn and how they make that particular situation go out into the world. And we've been now being led down a road where that says that now women, if you're aware of your sexuality and if you're there and if you're upfront with it and you say what you want and you go out and you're forceful in that sense, then that means that you have a sense of power. The other day I was sitting on a bus and I was listening to a young girl talking on the phone about her boyfriend and another friend. And she was so sexually explicit that I had to turn around and look at her and turn back. And I understand this is about socialization, but it's a situation where men have constantly been made to be men. And now women are taking on that role. It's like a role reversal.
Okay, and I'm going to have you take the answer to your question off the air, and I'm going to let Ted start in on that one.
Okay, the brother was saying a lot. I'm not sure what his question exactly was.
Well, what I was hearing is that he was talking about this situation where you see Oprah featuring these porn stars who are being seen as taking a leadership role, in that they're now profiting. They've cut out the middleman, and they're now profiting from the sale of their sexuality. Yeah. And he's commenting on a change in mores among young women, in which now you can go on a bus and hear a young woman being extremely sexually explicit and graphic in her conversation with her boyfriend and a friend. And what I was hearing is some chagrin about where this has gone, and it's kind of like this used to be for the boys.
Yeah. Thank you for...
I'm here.
Yeah, thank you. I would say that, an expression of sexuality, I don't have any judgment on that. So I'm not judging any expression of sexuality. But certainly the porn industry, whether the producers are women or whether the producers are men, is built on the backs and the exploitation, the sexual exploitation of women, and primarily fueled by men. So there's some fundamental problems there. I would also say that, many people, if I'm understanding what he said correctly, that these women are producing porn and were actually porn stars first. So that this was kind of the opportunities that were presented to women, and I want to also say that when we look at pornography and we look at judgment of women, there's not too many places that women are going to be paid what men are willing to pay them unless they exploit themselves in that way. So I'm not excusing the behaviors of women. I'm just saying that it's fueled by men. And again, for me and for our organization, it really gets back to if the demand is coming from men, we have to look at the demand. If the demand dries up, then there's not going to be films or not going to be producers. I don't know if Ms. Rice or Natalie, you want to add anything to that.
Well, actually, we're coming to the close of our time, so I wanted to give Deborah an opportunity just to restate, you know, what Stop It Now has to offer people and any final closing comments she has regarding the preventing of the sexual abuse of our children.
Sure. Stop It Now has an amazing online help center, which anyone who can get on the Internet can go to and put in a question and be led down a pathway for very detailed information. It's a little bit of an investment in terms of time and energy and focus, but well worth it. And we have the helpline service, and we have materials. But I just want to comment on this power dynamic and just say that if all of us would hold the question about whether or not an action that we're doing is good for this child or not good for this child, and set aside, you know, our needs being met, but the child's needs being met, whose needs are being met with what action, whether it's one that isn't abusive but it's just an everyday action toward children but takes away their sense of their own, you know, efficacy and power in the world themselves in terms of their own decision-making, all the way to abusive action. So this power dynamic that the last caller brought up is hugely important, and I think, you know, those are the kind of discussions we need to be having on TV.
Thank you so much, Deborah. Her organization is stopitnow.org. And, Ted, I want to just turn this over to you for a quick 30 seconds and your closing comments.
Yes. Thank you very much. And I want to thank the callers for their calls as well. A Call to Men has a website, calltomen.org. You can also email us at info@acalltomen.org. There's a lot of great information on there. Our focus is really around the prevention of domestic and sexual violence, and we're always looking for men to get involved. We're community organizers and provide technical assistance and do a lot of trainings to that end with all communities. So,
acalltomen.org. And I just want to thank you for joining us, everyone, listeners included, on Women, Body, and Soul, WBAI Pacifica Radio New York. Comments and feedback can be sent to me via Facebook, Natalie Tondiway, or info@womenbodyandsoul. Thank you for listening.
Women, Body, and Soul, Natalie Tandiway, and she shares this space every other Thursday at noon. Vicki Hufnagel, the ethical doctor, and she'll be on next week. Great stuff, Natalie Tandiway, another excellent program. Certainly not the first time that we've heard this, but certainly carrying us forward, and I do thank you for that. Again, stopitnow.org or acalltomen.org. This is listener-supported, commercial-free, community radio WBAI in New York. We're broadcasting at 99.5 FM, and we are on the web as well at WBAI.org, and you can find out that this radio station streams 24 hours a day at WBAI.org, and you can also find out how to contribute, how to donate, and continue to help this radio station go forward, as it's a listener-sponsored radio station. Coming up next at 1 o'clock will be The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille, so make sure to keep your dials right where they are.
this were 5 o'clock on a Thursday, that music would mark the beginning of Behind the News. But it's not, so instead I'm here to invite you to join me, Doug Henwood, as I comment on the economic news and interview a wide variety of guests, authors, activists, think tankers, and even the occasional Nobel Prize winner. Economics and politics from New York City to the world, what's happening and what it all means. Behind the News with Doug Henwood, Thursdays from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on WBAI.
Hey, WBAI listeners, this is Lewis Williams, or Dengan, on The Aliens. We have a special party just for you, the after party for the radio drama series The Aliens. Join our cast, crew, and other WBAI listeners on Sunday, April 25th at 8 p.m. at the famous Lower East Side Luca Lounge, located at 220 Avenue B. That's between 13th and 14th Street. Come down for free gourmet pizza, inexpensive drinks, and great music featured on the show. That's Sunday, 8 p.m., April 25th at Luca Lounge. RSVP.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.